Hello, my name is Father Gregory Pine, and it's my joy to welcome you back to the Thomistic Institute podcast for another installment of Off-Campus Conversations, where I follow up with a speaker who has spoken for the Thomistic Institute to continue the conversation and see if we can dive deeper on a couple of points proposed. So for this installment, I am delighted to be joined by Professor Michael Gorman. Thanks for joining.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Hey, my joy. So many folks will know you from your various talks given via the Thomistic Institute, well, just for Thomistic Institute students and recorded for the Thomistic Institute podcast. But then other people will know you because of things that you have written, like a book about the metaphysics of the incarnation, or by other things besides, for your contributions to the local community at St. Jerome's in Hyattsville. But for those who don't know you, what are some things they should know? Like, who are you and what do you do? And why is that?
Yeah.
Why is that count?
I teach at the philosophy at the Catholic University of America. I've been here. I just finished my 25th year at Catholic U. Yeah, since 1999 for the 20th.
That's awesome.
Century. I have children and grandchildren. Some of whom, many of whom, live like extremely in the same neighborhood as me, which is a real blessing. Yeah, I like philosophy. I like theology. And this should be a fun conversation.
Nice. Would you give a little commendation of the School of Philosophy at the Catholic University of America? Because I admire said school from across the street, because it seems like you have a really rich communal life. Like,
yeah.
It seems like you like philosophy and you like each other and you like doing philosophy with each other.
Yes. No, that's absolutely true. I feel really blessed, and I feel like, you know, God looks after us. Since about the early 60s, I think, the school sort of morphed into a place where it was sort of, in a sense, organized around doing the history of philosophy. As distinct from, you know, I guess maybe in the 40s or the 50s or something like that, like almost everybody was doing sort of a kind of what, you know, the thing that everybody always makes fun of, manual Thomism, right? It's probably was sometimes terrible and sometimes not nearly as bad as people say. But anyway, in the early 60s, this sort of transition was made. And so we usually have people covering almost every part of the history of philosophy. But we do this in a kind of interesting way. So basically, everybody thinks Aristotle's really important. And with that as a kind of lingua franca, you might say, we have people who do Plato and that kind of stuff. We have people who do Aristotle. We have people who do medieval. We have Thomas Aquinas people, but we also have Scotus people. I once performed a little song at our annual variety show called The Scotist and the Thomist Should Be Friends. And and we have people who do modern philosophy and, you know, German philosophy and analytic philosophy and everything. But the reason it doesn't fracture into a million people who can't talk to one another is partly because there is this common sense that, like, Plato's important, Aristotle's important, Augustine's important, Aquinas is important. But also because we're committed not merely to doing you know, archaeological historical research. But the reason we do the history stuff is because that's where you can dig up the really big philosophical nuggets by going back to those important sources. And so we have enough in common that we can have really good arguments. Like, we can, you know, you have to have something in common in order to have a disagreement. So we have like these fun disputes among ourselves and in a sort of lighthearted way. And, you know, if at any time I got home and my wife said, oh, so-and-so, naming one of my colleagues, is coming for dinner at the last minute, I would be fine with that. And I know a lot of people who work at other academic departments, and they would be horrified. But I like all my colleagues. So.
I think, too, like, part of that is a certain appreciation for subtlety without kind of pedantic hangups.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're a school of subtle takes. So when people trot out the blame the Franciscan argument,
right,
you know, you're going to come to the defense of said Franciscans, but you're not going to pull the typical sophomoric, well, actually. You know, I read this one thing in this one place and didn't digest it or interpret it, but it says something different. And so you should know that because I do, which is a bold strategy, but not often a winning one. So, yeah, I appreciated that in the most recent Thomistic Circles at which you contributed on the theme of SCOTUS.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But I don't know that I've yet become a native speaker in a second tradition. I think that I've just learned one tradition decently, and then I know what might be going on in other traditions, yeah. So I just refer to them like I don't know what's going on.
Right. Well, that can be, it can be really dangerous to think you know something. Like, I mean, this was maybe dumb, but there was this, well, it's too complicated, but like I ended up doing this interdisciplinary undergraduate major in part because I didn't want to commit to any particular major, in part because, for example, to do the religion major, I would have to do this course where in a 9-month, 1-year course, we did 11 religious traditions. And I thought I'd rather just accept the fact that I don't understand Hinduism than to study it for 3 weeks. I just felt
worse. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that sounds, yeah. No, it's hard. It's hard to determine like the appropriate level of superficiality or profundity with which to engage, because you always come up against human limitations, and in coming up against human limitations, there's a sweet consolation to the fact that you'll never know anything,
right,
and that you can despair of that inordinate desire to shrink the knowable world so that more of it fits in your head.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, you know,
yes,
the limitations are limitations. So,
yeah.
But maybe apropos of that, we could talk a little bit about the chosen theme, which is relativism.
Yeah.
You've spoken on relativism a couple times to Thomistic Institute chapters, and I appreciate the take that you kind of lead off with, because in certain popular settings, when relativism comes up, it's like, all right, get out the baseball bats or the cricket bats, if you prefer a kind of broader surface, and let's get to bludgeoning, boys.
Yeah.
Because obviously there are many things about relativistic positions, which at least on an initial approach sounds silly or sounds nefarious, or whatever else. But I think that you lead with a certain sympathy insofar as you'll help people to appreciate what's actually at stake and then what the relativist wants out of life. So could you lead us into that argument, or yeah, lead us into that thought world?
So the phenomenon that struck me in thinking through that talk, and I've given it a number of times, and people, it seems to resonate with people. On the one hand, a lot of people in our culture say relativist sounding things and essentially present themselves as relativists. They say things like, you know, what's true for you might not be true for me. Every person has his or her own truth, things like that. But then it turns out, if you pay attention to them, that they aren't actually relativists. And the way this can really jumps out is that they'll use their relativist speeches in the favor of in support of non-relativistic claims. So they'll say, you should not interfere with other people's lives because what's true for them might not be what's true for you, and vice versa. Truth is relative, therefore it's immoral to interfere with other people's lives. Now that last thing that I just said is like total non-relativism, right? You could say, you know, if you said in response to that person, oh, well, the thing is, I'm very special. For me, what's good is to interfere with other people's lives. So you're just going to have to accept that. They would go crazy. So it shows that they aren't really relativists. So that made me think, well, so then why do they talk like this all the time? So I think that in our culture, one use of relativist language is to try to create a space where people can be allowed to do their own thing without interference. And I think that's a legitimate thing. I think probably in our culture, we make that space larger than it needs to be. Or actually, I probably think we just make it to be the wrong shape. It's too large and we're too permissive in some areas and too restrictive in others. You know, it's possible to be too restrictive and too broad at the same time. But anyway, I think that the better thing to do is to drop all the relativism and just talk about what we should tolerate and what we should not tolerate. And I think the reason it's hard is because people have trouble understanding the idea that you should love the sinner and hate the sin. So they think that if you disagree with someone, you have to hate them. So some people say, well, other people are wrong, let's hate them. And other people are like, ooh, hating people is bad. It can't be that anything's wrong. But those are both incorrect views, I think. You just have to learn to be able to say to people, you're wrong about this. Can we like have coffee and talk about this? Because I think you're wrong. Or you don't know, I always have to talk about it. But I think that in a sense, it's a kind of inability to have a charitable confrontation and disagreement, which leads people either to cruelty and intolerance on the one hand, or an attempt to be relativist on the other.
Yeah, that's okay. That's interesting because I think it seems like a background concept is violence. Certainly violence has gotten a lot of play in the 20th and 21st century, not only physical violence, but, you know, violence of various shapes and sizes. Yeah. And so like you identify on the one hand, a fear of imposition, which eventuates on the other hand, in a kind of evacuation of, you know, any truth claims or morality claims. But it seems like there's got to be an intermediate space. To describe it as a mean between two extremes, I think is false because it's more of an extreme insofar as it more closely approaches the truth. But this kind of like space of debate, dispute, discussion,
yeah.
Invitation, provocation, like there's a lot of genres that fit within this space. Do you think, I mean, like, ideally, the university is a place in which just such type conversations can transpire, but it seems like socially and culturally, this ought to be something that's almost institutional or at the very least arises organically from our relationships. Do you find places where that's happening or do you have worries as to why that's not happening?
Yeah. I'm not sure. I mean, I think, you know, universities obviously ought to be places where people can talk about stuff that they disagree about. And one gets the impression that, I mean, I think sometimes people, I don't know, it's confusing. Like the things that get reported about campus craziness are often quite exciting. But when I go on, you know, when I go and give TI talks at various campuses, I usually ask the students, so what's it like, you know, most of the ones whom I'm meeting with are Catholic or anyway, they're Christians. And I say, so like, what's it like being a Catholic on your campus? What's it like being a Christian on your campus? And a lot of times they're like, oh yeah, there's some crazy stuff, but it's not as bad as everybody says. So I've started to wonder whether things are quite as bad as people say. It probably varies a lot more from school to school than people realize. But, you know, exciting stuff is what gets reported, right?
At least in the New York Times,
right? That's the
/ New York Post.
What?
Yeah. I said, at least in the New York Times, / New York Post.
I mean, what, you know, that is not a saying, if it bleeds, it leads. So, yeah. So anyway, but I do think, you know, it is hard. I do think that we're sort of probably a lot less tolerant a culture than we used to be. I wonder why. I mean, I do. Okay. So I could just go back to my earlier theory that it's because people don't know how to disagree and remain charitable, that they think you got to choose one or the other. You choose truth without love or love without truth. Did I say that right? You choose truth without love or love without truth. But you try, and, you know, we need to have both. But then, of course, that just raises a deeper question. What happened? You know, like, why is that harder to do in our culture? It sounds nice to say, well, it must be the decline of Christianity. And that's probably true to some extent. But there are probably other more, less exciting and pious sounding causes as well. You know, like it's hard for societies and groups to manage extremely large amounts of diversity. When it gets beyond a certain point, people start losing their ability to handle the whole thing. And so maybe like the good old days when, you know, the senator, the Democratic senator and the Republican senator would argue on the floor and then go out to dinner. Maybe that's because at that time they were actually closer in their views anyway, and it was easier to pull off. I'm not sure. I'm not totally clear on the underlying causes of this.
I think, and maybe this is taking it in a strange direction. If so, you just come back with a bitter rebuke and I will retool the conversation. But it strikes me that like certain virtues which ordinarily are in place are more extraordinarily, how do I phrase this? Things that ought to be there aren't there. And now, mind you, the struggle to cultivate virtue is always a struggle. So it's not to presume upon them being present in some historical golden age, after which we should just kind of, somewhat nostalgically. But that is to say, you've talked about charity, and you can even think about it in the kind of setting of the public square, where we're thinking more in terms of like justice, just like affability, or kind of gratitude, or whatever other things like that. But I also think too, like apropos of charity, a kind of mercy, whereby you recognize the pitiable state of the other and seek to alleviate it. But for me, I suppose that prompts the question whether there is some kind of virtue of tolerance, some kind of virtue for the public square, a natural virtue of a certain sort, which abides difference and doesn't catastrophize in the face of, you know, said difference. Well, I mean, like how would we identify the contours of that virtue, if it is in fact a virtue, or if it's just something more basic?
This is a really good question. And I'm like on my toes and on my guard, because you sort of like subtly went through a nice little list of Thomistic virtues there. And so I'm realizing what's at stake here. It may be. Then this is actually a really interesting question. So I think it seems to me tolerably obvious. Ha ha. It seems to me clear enough that something in the ballpark of what we would call tolerance is something in the ballpark of a virtue. Okay. But it may actually turn out that there is no special distinct virtue that we should label tolerance. It's actually just reducible to one or several other virtues, like justice and, you know, affability and mercy. I'm not sure. It's actually a really good question. It's possible that like it actually is its own virtue, and that it wasn't flagged so clearly in the tradition for whatever reason, and it should be done now. Or it could be that it's not, it's actually just sort of a place where several other virtues intersect, and that it's important to understand it in terms of those virtues, those other ones. Because for all we know, here's a sort of hypothesis. Maybe if you treat it as its own distinct thing, it gets distorted. But I don't know. I'm just making this up. This is a very interesting question.
Well, let's pursue. I mean, this is a safe space. I'm not looking to jump down your throat and condemn you as having fallen afoul of Thomistic orthodoxy. I'm genuinely interested in the question because I just don't know what it is. Because I think when a lot of believers hear tolerance, they think indifferentism, right, or latitudinarianism or nonsense.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably a good instinct, because that's how it's gone in many cases and many times and places. But then I think about God.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, mind you, how well do I know what's going on there? I know how God is not to some degree or extent. Okay. So then, you know, St. Thomas has a couple of passages where he talks about the preexistence and virtue of God. So I'm thinking in terms of like, okay, if there's something in us that's good, it might preexist in God.
Right.
Perhaps not as a transcendental perfection or as a pure perfection, but maybe like a kind of mixed perfection and an idea and yada, yada. Okay. So that being the case, it seems that God puts up with a lot. All right. And I don't think that I'm like speaking metaphorically here. I think there's something analogical to it, in the sense that God abides our nonsense. Now, he does so pedagogically and providentially unto the end. But like over the course of our life, God tolerates quite a bit. And I'm like wondering what divine perfection we're identifying here. Because if we speak about it in terms of patience, we're speaking improperly. Because like patience is kind of about fortitude, and fortitude is kind of about emotions, and God kind of doesn't have emotions.
Right.
So like like what, like when we refer to like longanimity or long stuff, what are we talking about? Like, what is the proper perfection? Or maybe we could just drill down.
Yes.
And identify something like that.
Well, somewhere St. Thomas says that the lawgiver should not try to make everything bad illegal. And one of his reasons is that you have to create greater injustices in order to enforce it. So you could think of things that would be great if we could like prevent everyone from doing them. But the intrusiveness that would be required is just absolutely outrageous. And there could be other reasons too. Like sometimes, I mean, that's only one reason, and it's probably not the only reason he gives. But it was the one that sprang to mind. But there are a number of reasons to not harass people every time they're wrong, right? Sometimes just the harassment becomes a kind of injustice on its own. Although, if I'm not careful, that just becomes a question-begging argument, right? Because somebody who just denies that there's anything good about tolerance would say, well, what's so bad about harassing people until they go crazy? Right, like it's sort of presupposing that you're supposed to. Sorry, that was a dangerous thing I just said there. I don't know. I could probably fix it if I had a little time. But anyway, but I think sort of intuitively we could tell you don't just go around. You don't just like walk up to people in the subway and say, you know, and just correct them everything they're doing. And you shouldn't be reading that book and all. Right, you just got to let people alone. But also, you know, sometimes people have to learn things for themselves. Sometimes if you just push people too far, they crack, and then they're not going to improve. There's all kinds of reasons why you can't fix everything right away all the time. But to put it that way is to presuppose that there are things that need fixing. Like, I mean, I think tolerance, whatever it might mean, what it needs to mean is that you're tolerating something bad, something that you think is bad, right? You don't tolerate good things. You tolerate bad things. So I quite agree that often when people talk about tolerance, they're really talking about indifferentism. But if you just think about what the word tolerance ought to mean, it's a completely non-indifferent thing. You're aware of evils and you've decided for now you're not going to push it.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe there's something to be said. So thinking about your observations with respect to corrections, you know, like you're in the subway and this person's reading Ayn Rand and you're like, oh man, she's totally wrong on altruism and egotism and you shouldn't bother with that nonsense. And somebody over here is, you know, like playing Candy Crush. And it's like, you can't possibly be spending your time in such non-profitable fashion when the glory of God is just on the other, whatever, you know? So, okay. You just become intolerable yourself. And it seems like You got two poles in correction. You got the other person who's doing something bad, and then you got you, who may or may not be responsible or may not be duty bound. And then you've got the actual exchange. And it seems like we're only responsible for certain things. And it seems like one of the things for which we are responsible is ensuring that the exchange is loving in some way, shape, or form. Maybe just to talk about it in simplest fashion. it just seems like that for which we're responsible and then the loving exchange, they're probably kind of hard to legislate, or they're probably hard to define. Maybe that's also part of the reason for which we kind of fall back on toleration or tolerance, because it requires basically nothing. It's like, to what extent are we just kind of managing our social anxieties, or to what extent are we just trying to delimit the bounds within which I can feel myself safe from potential aggression, violence, inordinate correction for which the other party is not responsible? Like, I don't know. I'm muddling around right now, but shed light.
Do we sometimes fall back on the notion of tolerance as a way of dodging the harder question, which requires a lot of prudential case-by-case judgment calls? The harder question of when do I engage in fraternal correction and when do I not?
Yeah,
that might be right, you know, because it can be very hard to know when you should. I mean, we probably most of us err more in one direction than in the other, but probably each of us occasionally errs in both directions. I mean, not at the same time, likely. But sometimes you overcorrect people. You know, you just like walk up to them and say, I just wanted to let you know that, you know, you're drinking your coffee wrong. I just thought I should say that. And other times you just sit there and like watch your friends making a really large mistake. And you're like, I don't know. Should I say something? And like, you should, you know, you're their friend. So, but it's often quite hard to know what to do. And you can mess it up, and it's nerve wracking. Like somebody who's always confident that they know what to do, I'm suspicious of that person because they're probably overconfident. It can be difficult. But yeah, just this, one way to dodge the question would be to just establish a universal policy of never bugging anybody. That would be like a lazy way out. I agree with that.
Yeah. So it strikes me in describing this, like fraternal correction is one mode, but then St. Thomas will talk about correction and justice. And we can think about it like as governed by charity, those are going to be the equal to equal type relationships.
Yeah.
And then as governed by justice, those are going to be like the superior to inferior type relationships. And maybe it's helpful then to distinguish between tolerance like among friends or tolerance among colleagues or business associates, and then tolerance at the level of the state or the polity.
Yes.
Because maybe when we talk about them as if they were the same thing, then we get ourselves confused.
That's true.
Because we're like, you know, like the United States government shouldn't tell people like what to believe and how to comport themselves as concerns religious exercise. But like, does that mean that I shouldn't?
Right.
I mean,
those are different points.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, because
it's your job to tell people what to think about religion.
It seems that way.
And, you know, like if a student gives me a paper and it's kind of confused, it's my job to tell them that. Now, how to tell them that, when to tell them that, like this is where the tricky stuff comes in, but it doesn't mean that it's not part of your job. And just like, I mean, the same thing applies to you, right? Like, I mean, you know, I mean, you deal with it a lot more. I mean, everybody has to deal with this problem sometimes. Like there are people who are like coming and asking for help or advice. And sometimes you need to tell them like, you know, you're messing that up. But it happens to you probably 10 times as often as it does to me. It can be tricky to know, like sometimes you just got to lay down the law with people. And other times you need to like beat around the bush and let them, you know, drop hints. Some people will respond very well to an argument, like really a syllogism, and other people, you just need to like tell them a story and they're like, oh, right. A really clever, able person will be able to make all these judgment calls, but it's hard. But anyway, back to your point, I agree that like thinking about friends, fellow family members, colleagues, fellow citizens, that's different from what, you know, relations of superiors to inferiors. And it's probably the case that stronger obligations of letting things slide are that people in charge are simultaneously both sometimes under greater obligations to overlook things and greater obligations to not overlook things. Because like they're responsible for order, right? And so they have to like not let things get out of control. But on the other hand, there are times where they just have to like, it's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's like they have a peculiar solicitude for the common good, but they also have to ensure that this doesn't become a police state in which the enforcement of law becomes, practically speaking, intolerable. Yeah. It strikes me too that like, you know, there's a kind of political prudence, which is a participation in the providence of God.
Yeah.
And then there's a kind of like amicable prudence. I don't know what you would call it. Economic prudence would be something that St. Thomas actually identifies as perhaps approaching what we're trying to get at, which is in a certain sense responsible for less, and as a result of which probably more particular and peculiar in its expression. But it's like you think about fraternal correction. You have to believe in the providence of God if you're going to correct somebody.
Yes.
Because you have to admit the possibility that this is going to go poorly. It's like, well, I'm the practitioner, so chances are decent that this won't come off well. But you also have to believe that like this somehow fits within a story of salvation. Because like, I could not do anything. But then like, what's the point of being his friend? I mean, like care, concern, solicitude, support, all those things are good. But if it's like a weak care, concern, solicitude, support that's afraid of offending and potentially alienating, right, then how much is it really, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, like, I realized that, yeah, I mean, it might Well, yeah, there's just so many ways in which it could be tough. And maybe that's just like we're getting at the anxiety of the relative. I mean, I don't know how much the relativist thinks about these things, but the potential anxiety of the relativist, it's like it can be easier just to make for oneself a universal precept that just says, don't engage.
Right. Yeah. 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 No, it's the thing about provenance is important because just to take up the opposite side of the balance that you were just saying, like, okay, so it's, I think it's true not only that having a weak faith in providence might lead us to not be open to the fact, to the possibility that if we try to offer a correction or something to someone, that it could just go badly, but maybe it was worth doing anyway. But also, a weak faith in providence could be a cause of overcorrecting other people, right? It's like, you know, do I have to do everything around here? Right? And actually, I don't. That's God's job. And so, you know, I don't, when I look around the subway and I see somebody playing Candy Crush, you know, I don't automatically have to intervene.
Yeah. No, it's for the best.
I'm sitting on the bus and I see somebody, you know, keeping her toddler entertained with a cell phone, and it makes me want to cry, but like, it's probably not my job to say, hey, listen, let me tell you how to raise toddlers. You're doing it wrong. You know?
Yeah, probably not. Okay. Then how about let's turn back to relativism. So interesting to explore.
Can I just
go ahead? Yeah.
I want to insert something here.
Please do.
I wonder whether a certain factor about our culture, certain fact about it, has made it harder for us to develop these abilities to manage disagreement, the sometimes need for correction, the sometimes need for letting things slide. And that fact about our culture is that it's easier to get away from people that we don't like. You don't have to hang out with them. You can spend all your time on social media, reading a nicely curated blend of, you know, I don't know what the correct ratio is, but mostly opinions that I agree with and occasionally opinions that really, really anger me to keep me excited and engaged with the newsfeed or whatever it is. And, but if you think of, you know, living in a family, you're stuck with these people. Now, of course, a lot of people don't really live family life in that way. Their house is like a hotel, and they don't have dinner together, and they don't have to put up with one another. And when they do, they're all on their phones anyway. So this is, but if you live in it in a more engaged way, then you have to put up with everybody else's faults, and you have to learn through practice when to tell somebody, hey, that's not okay, and when it's like it's actually a me problem. I don't like the way they do it, but like, that's on, you know, it's my problem, right? And sort of their analogy, you know, analogically, right? In a religious community, you're always bumping up against the other friars, and you have to learn how to negotiate that. And in jobs in small towns, you know, you keep running into the same people over and over again. You have to learn how to get along with them. And I just wonder whether some facts about our mobile and internetified society makes it easier for us to live in spaces where we don't have to learn these virtues or whatever. I'm scared to use the word, but you know what I'm saying? We don't have to learn how to do this.
Yeah. I wonder too about like the geopolitical setting. So I think about the United States, you know, we live in Washington, D.C. Our nearest neighbor is probably, you know, 700 miles away if we were to drive to Canada from here. Our next nearest neighbor is probably like, you know, 1,800 miles away if we were to drive to Mexico from here. Yeah. And so we kind of, you know, we can swagger a little bit and do whatever suits our fancy because we're not too terribly worried about upsetting those at our borders. Whereas like in Europe, I lived in Switzerland for a little while. There's like a different sense of toleration, or there's a different sense of conflict management there. I noted it in the Dominican community, like the way that, you know, you kind of sussed out a point or talked through a point, just had a different feel to it. And maybe that's just me kind of injecting my own thoughts on the matter. But I think too, like part of the virtuousness, as it were, of putting up with conflict or managing conflict in peaceable ways can be culturally mediated. And in part, it might depend upon, you know, like the last time there's been a land war in the United States, whatever, 1812, or maybe they lobbed some shells from like on the Oregon coast in the Second World War. But like, right. It's been a minute, you know?
Yeah. No, that's certainly right. Yeah.
So they're like, there might even be a way to which, like, relative, not to say that relativism is a uniquely European phenomenon. Obviously, it exists on our own shores, but maybe it has different expressions in different geopolitical settings. But maybe there's a sense in which, like, relativism is a reaction to trauma. I don't want to, like, over-emotionalize this or psychologize this, but it might just be, like, a way of protecting oneself.
Yeah, and it's a sort of historical cliche that the tolerance views coming out of the Enlightenment were in part a response to the religious wars of the 16th century, right? I mean, that's plausible. Sometimes you just get sick of fighting with people, or you just realize that this is not good, right? This is toxic. We're just fighting too much. Let things slide. The danger is that you get an overcorrection, which one could argue, you know, has happened, where you just allow almost anything to happen. Like, who cares how people raise their children, right? Well, no, that's not going to work out.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I think, like, with respect to, you know, relativism sliding towards indifferentism, it's just a question of how neutral one can remain vis-a-vis the good. It's like, can we as a society agree in some way, shape, or form as to what constitutes the good? You know, like, do we think that religious practice is a good? You know, we can point sociologically or statistically to the ways in which it leads to family coherence and, you know, psychological adjustment. It's like, can we agree upon those things? I think what we're finding is more and more, at least in the United States, the answer is no. And it's just like, to what degree or extent is that connected with the kind of relativism and tolerance that have morphed or that have slid or that have otherwise shifted while we weren't kind of babysitting them?
Yeah. See, it's weird because a lot of people, if you ask them, should government and society be neutral on the good, they might say yes. But almost no one, it seems to me, actually thinks that. So, for example, most people think that at least most of the time, shooting your neighbor should be, you know, against the law, right? So right away, and the fact is a lot of people who claim to be very tolerant, they're very intolerant. They are mean. So they're intolerant of you for not. It's not only that they want you to be tolerant of certain things, but you have to approve of certain things. If you just go like, well, I mean, if you actually just said, look, you know, just pick some controversial issue. You say, well, I understand that other people do that, and I'm okay with it being legal, but I'm not excited about that. I think that's bad, and it's going to lead to bad social consequences. People will get really mad at you for that. They do not tolerate this opinion. So I think it would be healthier for everybody to just stop saying let's be relativists, and just to come out in the open and say, look, we're all going to have to take stands on certain things. I already do have stands on certain things, and so do you. Some of them we agree, so let's be happy about that, and then let's talk about the other ones and start talking about it, and trying to do it in charity. Because if we pretend that we're not taking stands, I think it's just going to come out in more weird and toxic ways.
Yeah. So then, like, the good at stake, at least in the discourse, would be an open conversation as to what constitutes the good, some modicum of political compromise such that things at least representative of goods espoused by the citizenry themselves are, you know, they're present or enshrined in law and judicial practice. And then if there are things that people find intolerable or bridging on intolerable, then you can begin to devise political solutions for their redress or for their kind of at least ongoing conversation or whatever else it might be.
Yeah. And we were talking earlier about how, like, in your personal life or whatever, this stuff can be kind of situational and require prudential judgments, right? Some people prefer to be corrected or called out very explicitly. And if you beat around the bush, they get ticked off. Like, just say it, right? Other people get really hurt if you do that and you drop little subtle hints and then they are grateful that you weren't confrontational. All right. So you have to make a lot of judgment calls. Well, I think like there's something analogous to that on the social and political level. Not every society can be run along the same lines because it depends on who the people are, their level of education, and the degree of diversity within the society. Like you can't, it's just a fact that has to be managed, and you can't say, well, I don't care how much religious diversity there is currently in our culture, we are going to establish this religion and it begins in 10 minutes. Like you can't, that's just not a real plan. That's LARPing. So you do have to like try to work your way through. But it's much easier to just go and tweet stuff than to actually try to solve problems.
Right. Yeah, maybe that's a good point with which to conclude. I mean, it's like it's a sobering point, you know, because I think that from a certain vantage, it is subjectively satisfying to make a bold or courageous tweet, or I don't know what the actual verb would be. But somebody was recounting to me that there was a documentary that was put out a couple of years ago about a famous person who a lot of people like, so I'm not going to identify him or her, but that it like kind of mounted to a climax of a brave or courageous tweet. And my first reaction was like, I don't know that there is such thing as bravery and courage on the internet. Maybe there is, but it just strikes me as a kind of bravery / courage neutral space. It's like whatever you, I mean, it's like doesn't have a real consequence. I mean, unless it does.
Yeah.
So maybe it's about like accommodating the discourse to the actual persons participating who, you know, can contribute to some common good or can actually invest in it.
Yeah. Wait, so I missed the very last point you're making. I thought you were going to go on. That's why there's this big pause.
Oh, no. Yeah. No, quite naturally. I think I'm going to go on most times too, but then I realized that it's been lengthy. And so I try to just end. No. I wasn't accusing you of that. I mean, I'm always trying to figure out how what I say ends.
Right.
So I think that what I'm looking for is like part of what it means to be, because you made this point about family life and you made this point about the kind of atomization or balkanization of civil society where it's like we live to a great degree in isolation, as a result of which we don't have to, you know, cultivate the virtues whereby we put up with other people and their differences, or whereby we put up with ourselves and our own fecklessness. So it strikes me that like coming together is part of the story. It answers to the anxiety, maybe the trauma, the fear that informs a lot of this. Let's talk about relativism, or let's say it's relativistic, because it seems like that we should be trying to navigate these problems within the appropriate social or political setting. That is to say, like with the people whom it concerns in a way that brings us together and actually engages us around the table, rather than doing it in weird ways or untoward ways or ways that don't actually get to the problem and bring people together in meaningful senses. So it was just kind of it petered out there.
I get it. Right. And we had, that was in the context in which that arose was that we were talking about Twitter. Like you have these weird, you know, virtual spaces where your interlocutors are the people that you who happen to see it, right? They might not be in the same room as you or the same city as you or the same continent as you. Their sense of how they're engaged in this. Like it's one thing to, I mean, let's pick an example of something that seems like a lost art, local politics, town level politics or city level politics, right? It's probably easier. Okay, I'm just going to say this crazy thing. It might not be true. It's probably easier if you're a clever writer and producer of social media content to get people all around the planet excited about your campaign for, you know, whatever. Financial responsibility in your own town than to get people in your own town. Like if you're good at sending out tweets, then like someone from 2,000 miles away would be like, yeah, let them have it. And you know, why do they care? They don't live here. Right. But to get your neighbors, that's a lot harder.
Yeah.
But like, we have to try to resist this and to live in the actual physical world that we live in with like people. Like, we're rational animals.
Yeah.
We're not angels.
Yep. We aren't. Have you ever come across Thomas Harmon, who teaches at UST in Houston? I think I'm getting his name right, but he's writing a book. It's called like a Demonology of the Internet.
Oh, nice.
Just kind of likening internet communication, well, data storage and recall and communication to communication amongst demons.
Yes.
Which is fascinating when you think about it at the level of like, you know, Madison Avenue manipulation. So,
yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we've come to the typical end of an off-campus conversation, but do you have any final thoughts, final commendations, or things you want to share apropos of the theme?
Well, I think in a way, this is, I have something, maybe what I would say is going to sound very cliched, but sometimes cliches are true. I think if most of us are alarmed about these kinds of problems. And I think that a really important first step and a necessary first step is to scale back the scale of operations. And so what I should do, the first thing, and maybe the second thing I should do about this, is not to come up with a really good tweet that will change everybody's minds on this, but instead to like be kinder to my neighbors, or the next time something comes up, some tense thing, to choose neither, you know, a rude, insulting remark or silence, but to actually think of a charitable way to engage, but to do it in the 3D physical world, IRL, as they say, and to try to choose this small local physical context over the broader virtual context. And so many of us are used to kind of dwelling in that virtual context that it feels weird to do it, and hard. But I think it's important. And, you know, if everybody did this, a lot of the problems would just resolve themselves automatically, without, you know, no one has to figure out the right tweet. We just all be kinder to our neighbors and we'll spend less time on the internet. That would be a huge first step. I really do think this.
Yeah. Yeah. When your backstop is humanity or a human being, a concrete existing person, rather than the algorithm, it's more likely that your social interactions will be humanizing rather than dehumanizing. So cool. Hey, well, thanks so much for taking the time and for entertaining a somewhat musing-filled/rambling-filled disquisition.
No, this
or
was
I should
fun.
Say exchange.
This was fun. Very, very thought-provoking.
All right, cool. Well, seeing as we live in the same city, I imagine that I'll see you soon. So I'll look forward to the next opportunity.
All righty. Thanks so much.
Cheers. Turning to you, the listener, thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Off Campus Conversations. If you haven't yet, please do subscribe to the podcast on your podcast app or on YouTube, unless you find that it's not good for your spiritual growth, and then promptly unsubscribe or don't subscribe or run to the hills, buy a large parcel of land in the country and get yourself a cow. So know of our prayers for you. Please pray for us, and we'll look forward to chatting with you next time on the Thomistic Institute podcast.